This is Desiree Hargis, graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports, Institute for Olympic Studies. Today I'm interviewing Art Lambert over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games, and today is Tuesday, November 15th. Mr. Lambert, can you begin with your name and where and when you were born?
Yeah, my name is Art Lambert. I was born in San Francisco on September 27th, 1935.
Okay. And where did you grow up?
I grew up down the peninsula in the Bay Area, basically, my entire life.
And what were some of your early athletic pursuits?
Basically, it was basketball, and then it morphed into water polo and swimming in my latter years in high school.
So what sports did you regularly participate in to start out with, and who got you involved in those first early sports?
Well, we were just sort of playground rats. There was no organized athletics such as Little League baseball or Babe Ruth baseball or Pop Warner football, anything like that. So as freshmen in high school, you know, we tried out for everything, football, basketball, baseball, what have you. And I played baseball and basketball my first couple of years, and then it morphed into swimming because I was pretty successful at that. And then in my last year was water polo in high school.
Okay. And was there anybody specific in your family who really encouraged your participation in water polo?
No, not really. My dad was busy working for a living. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. I used to ask my dad, he'd only see me play maybe once or twice. Obviously, water polo was not a sport that he was really familiar with. He was a baseball player. And I said, why don't you come to more games? And he said, look, son, he said, this is your thing. It's not mine. He said, I'll support you 100%. He said, and I do. He said, but you're the one that's doing the performing here. I contrast that with today's, you know, parents who are helicopter parents.
Mm-hmm, definitely. That's a big difference. So why did you choose water polo over some of the other sports that were available to you?
Well, actually, basketball was my love, and I was, I thought, and others have told me I was pretty good at it, but I got cut at my junior year, and I wasn't very big at that time, and I'm 6'1 now, and I was about 5'5 or 5'6 then. I was a late bloomer, and I got cut, and was so upset that I went and joined a rec team and led the league in scoring, and then decided, the hell with it. I was a good swimmer, and somebody said, why don't you play water polo? You know, there's some similarities between water polo and basketball, not a lot, but a few. And so I did, and the first game I saw, I played in, which was my senior year in high school.
Hmm. And that was the very first game you saw, and you also played in it?
That's correct.
Okay, how did that work?
Well, I guess it worked out pretty well. I certainly have no complaints.
Uh-huh. So were you kind of recruited for that last minute, or was it a tryout, or?
No, I was asked to come out because I could swim, and they said, why don't you play, they found out I was a basketball player, why don't you play water polo? I said, okay, I'll try it. So I did.
Okay. And did you have any friends on the water polo team or friends on the swim team that kind of joined with you or kept you involved in water polo?
Well, some of my swimmers on the swim team my junior year were the ones that encouraged me to come out for water polo.
Okay.
So, yes, to answer your question, yes.
Tell me a little bit more about how, from high school, playing water polo in high school, you were able to take it to a more elite level of competition.
Well, I had been approached. We had a pretty good high school team my senior year, and we played well. And a couple of players who had played in college in the Bay Area, i.e. San Jose State and Stanford, said, why don't you play water polo in college? And I thought, well, maybe. I was sort of ticketed to go to a junior college. And I was then prevailed upon by San Jose State to come to San Jose State. There were no athletic scholarships then or anything like that for water polo or swimming, for that matter. And so I ended up at San Jose State.
And what years were you there?
I graduated in high school in 1953, so I was there from 53 to 58.
And you played for San Jose State, you played water polo?
I played water polo and swam at San Jose State.
And what was your competitive career like there? What were some of the highlights?
Well, I was a three-time All-American, and, leading scorer, I guess, on the water polo team. I was one of the first swimmers that San Jose State had that made the NC2As in swimming. So I had a pretty good career there.
Mm-hmm. And then what about your career after your undergraduate degree? Did you continue on for a master's?
Yeah, I went on for a master's, and I got a job teaching and coaching at Ewald High School, which is in the Bay Area, Mountain View to be specific. The name has subsequently been changed to Mountain View High School because they closed down another one, so they moved the name over. And I coached there. I taught 4 hours of world history, Western Civ and Russian history to be specific, and coached water polo and swimming at the high school level.
Okay. And Ewald is spelled A-W-A-L-T?
That's correct. It was named after one of the trustees, Chester F. Ewald.
And during which years did you work there?
Worked there from 19, I was in the service, so it'd be from 59 to 61. I worked there 62 to 67, I want to say.
Okay. So that leads us up to right before the I guess let's talk about 1967 and leading up to the games in 68.
Okay.
So can you tell me a little bit about the big competitions in 67 and your role there and then what you were doing?
Well, we had a very successful high school team. We were undefeated for 5 years against high school competition.
Oh, wow.
And at the same time, in 1965, we formed a club team, which in those days was how they picked the Olympic teams and Pan Am teams, and based on your performance in the summertime. And so I formed a club. We won the national championship in 65. We won it again in 66.
And what was the name of that club?
It was called the Foothill Aquatic Foundation.
Okay.
And so we won the national championship those 2 years. Then we went into the Pan American trials, and we won the Pan Am trials, which in those days, if the winning coach would become the coach of the national team.
Mm.
So I was named as coach of the 1967 Pan Am team for the games that were held in Winnipeg. And we won the gold medal. And subsequently, they decided to go to a national team format, picking various players from a number of different teams, and asked me if I wanted to be the coach of the 1968 Olympic Games team. And I said, sure, why not?
Yeah.
And so we ended up going to Mexico City, and we lost lost. We took fifth, but we lost two matches and beat the East Germans at that time. They had one of the best teams in the world. We beat them.
Mm.
And on that team were two or three of my high school players that played for me during the early 60s.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite a run for that one anyway.
Yeah. So you were living there in the Bay Area just prior to the games, and you were still working at the high school there and for the Foothill Club?
Yes, I was coaching the Foothill Aquatic Foundation, and then in 1967 I was hired to work at De Anza College, which was a two-year college, community college, located probably 5 miles from the high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it represented a, increase in pay and all of that. And so I took the next step and went to work at De Anza and subsequently changed the name of the club from the Foothill Aquatic Foundation to the De Anza Aquatic Foundation. And we won the 69, 70, and 71 national titles.
Wow, quite a few national titles.
Right. So we had, up to that point, we had a total of six. And that led to the 1972 games where I was the assistant coach.
Mm. I have read that.
Pardon me?
I said I have read that.
Yeah. So I got in coaching in two Olympiads.
That's pretty amazing.
Well, yeah.
So were you married, and did you have a family in the year prior to the 68 games?
Yes, I did. I had two children, one born in 1961 and one born in 1964.
And what was your family's reaction to finding out that you were going to be the coach of the Olympic team?
Oh, I think, happiness, excited. I think, actually, the kids were pretty young then, so they didn't really, I don't think they appreciated exactly what it was. I know my dad didn't get on board until I was named the Pan Am Games coach and started receiving publicity in the newspaper. he thought, oh, this was great.
Did anyone else, any of your coworkers or any of your other friends have any reaction to the publicity?
Oh, they were all thrilled.
Uh-huh.
I was very fortunate the places where I worked. Like I was working at De Anza in 1968 and the whole staff rallied around. They found a substitute for me to coach my water polo team while I was at the Olympics.
Hmm. How did your training schedule and the competition schedule, especially as a coach, it seems like it would be an even harder schedule. How did that schedule affect your work or your relationships with your family?
Oh, I don't think it affected it one iota. We were gone and pre-training for the Olympics. We were training at the Air Force Academy because of the altitude. And we knew that Mexico City was, a mile high, and so was the Air Force Academy. We actually stayed at a place 1,000 feet above that, trying to get ready and get acclimated to Mexico City. And so I was gone for about 3 weeks before. But that all seemed good. Didn't seem to be a problem.
Yeah. So the trials, going back a little bit, speaking of the Air Force Academy, you said you had been in the military?
Yes, I was a first lieutenant in the Army.
And that was between
59 to 61.
Okay, so was that was right after your master's? Or just before?
I was working on my master's. I actually received my master's, Desiree, in 1965.
Oh, okay. So you were in the military while still going to school?
No, just, I had finished my degree, joined the service, time in the Army in Georgia, and then got out and got my first job at AWOLT, and then served my active reserve duty until 1965, and then actually, coincidentally, I guess, I got my master's degree in 65. But I was, you know, working for a living then, going to school at night, that kind of a thing.
Oh, okay. So, did you get to continue with your sport while you were in the military?
No, I did not.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to transition back into coaching the sport and working in the sport after being in the military?
Well, I played on two teams that won the national titles with the Olympic Club in 1957 and 1959.
Mm.
And then I went in the service. When I got out, I played one more year as a player. Decided I couldn't coach and play at the same time. So decided to hang it up. At that point, I was, close to 30, I guess, 28, 29 years old. And the bloom was off the lily. So I just started coaching full-time in 1961 at high school.
So tell me about that decision. Why did you feel you couldn't coach and play at the same time anymore?
Well, my body was telling me I couldn't, number one. And number two, time constraints. I had a family. I had a full-time job. I was trying to get a master's degree. I really didn't have time in the summertime to devote to, you know, to doing that.
But you...
I had injured my back.
Mm.
Somewhere along the line, and that precluded my really doing a lot.
So it wasn't a choice between playing or coaching. It was coaching more of a way for you to stay.
Well, coaching was my life's work. I mean, that was my career path, or at least it seemed so at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Although in retrospect, I look back on it, I don't know that I actually sat down and said, "Well, I can't do this because of this." But I just sort of morphed into, you know, coaching because I realized that I couldn't play anymore that much. So I decided, you know, it's time to coach and just put my full attention into coaching rather than trying to be a player. And I didn't want to be one of these guys that kept hanging on and hanging on and hanging on.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of people that just step away from the sport altogether. How do you feel about your decision not to do that, but instead to remain involved in the sport as a coach?
Oh, I think it was a great decision.
Mm-hmm.
I have no qualms or no second guessing about my deciding to stay in water polo and coach. Not at all.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the Olympic trials in 68. What was the process there? Was there anything significant that happened during the trials? Any problems or challenges?
No, except that I had been appointed as the head coach, so my team, we had to play down in the Coliseum in Los Angeles, and we got beat. We took second place, and some people were upset with the fact that I had been named as the national team coach, and they had gone away from the winning coach being the coach of the national team. But this had nothing to do with me, per se, because I wasn't on the committee and I didn't go in and vote. I was called after we won the Pan American Games. I was called that the committee had decided they wanted to name me as the national team coach, and they wanted to break ranks with the old format of doing it, where the winning coach would take his team plus four spares. You were allowed 11, and seven people started on the team. So the coach would take his team plus four spares. Well, they wanted to make it more national in scope, and so not necessarily with 7 and 4. It could be any, you know, get players from other teams as well, which was good because there were other players on other teams who were good. And so they made that decision after we won the gold medal in Winnipeg. They made that decision to do that. And I think that created some some animosity on the part of a few people, that especially the team that won, you know, why was not our coach selected, blah blah blah. So outside of that, you know, I don't think there's any problems with it. The Olympic trials proceeded as planned. It was a good one. And when that was over, we took a couple weeks off and then headed into our training regimen. All I might add, Desiree, without being paid.
Oh my goodness. So how were you and the members of the team supported during that time?
It was per diem and from the AU Water Polo Committee. We started working out, I believe, at Los Alamitos in Los Angeles. And then we went up to the Air Force Academy and trained for 2 to 3 weeks. And then flew to Mexico City.
So you were provided some per diem from the AU?
Yeah, we were provided a per diem, you know. Honestly, I can't remember how much money, but there were no salaries. I mean, I didn't make any money off of it.
Mm-hmm. Very different.
Nor did any of the other coaches, nor did the players, for that matter. It was purely Avery Brundage's last Olympics, and this was purely a amateur, right, according to his rules.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult?
Well, yes, in the sense that fortunately I didn't lose any money because I was coaching in a public institution and somebody came in and substituted for me, so I was continuing to get a paycheck. But I think a lot of the players, some of whom were older then, you know, in their mid-20s, I mean, they had jobs, a couple had families. Most of the employers in those days would, you know, oh, you're going to play in the Olympics, well, that's fine, you know, we'll take care of you, don't worry about it. But, I mean, it was hard, I'm sure.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about your training regimen, and in particular the altitude training and any of the effects you noticed there.
Well, obviously the proposal is to, because you have to play over a sustained period of time, you have to get acclimated. If you don't, you feel it in about 3 or 4 days after you're at the altitude, then it begins to kick in. So to stay at altitude 2 or 3 weeks and get acclimated is fine. If you're going to play just one match or one game at altitude, you fly in the day before, play, and get out. You don't suffer from that problem. But if you're going to play over a sustained period of time, which we did because the Olympics were 2 weeks, I think two and a half weeks long, you know, and this Olympics was not like 72. 72, you played every day, your venue was over, and you could go home or stick around and watch if you wanted to. 68, you'd play a couple of days, have a day or two off where you'd practice and play again. I definitely preferred the 68 Olympics because it gave you a chance to get around, meet people, see people. There was no reason to get home because you still had to play. And I think they referred to the 68 Olympics as the friendly Olympics because it certainly was.
That's nice. So did you notice the effects of the high altitude on your players when you were in Colorado Springs?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It kicked in about 3 or 4 days later, and it took a while. It took a couple of days, 3 days, to really get back up to speed. But it was a good thing we did, and thank goodness that the Air Force Academy was available.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys do any strength training or weightlifting?
No. Weightlifting then was just in its infancy. All of the, you know, training aids, you know, diet and weight training and conditioning things were all the things you sort of think about today were sort of unheard of then.
Hmm. Any other training regimen things that you can remember that kind of stick out in your mind?
No, just, you know, twice a day. And down at the Air Force Academy, we'd eat in the Air Force mess hall with the cadets.
Mm-hmm.
And just had about 20 players in the camp, and then we just started, you know, making cuts as we saw fit and as the situation demanded it till we got down to 11 players.
When you went to the games, did all 11 players actually play during game time in the water?
Most of the time, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody played. Everybody got a chance to play. Nobody was. We had a couple of injuries to boot. So, no, without question, people, you know, everybody played.
That's wonderful. I've heard that on some teams, some not necessarily water polo teams, but just on some U.S. teams, not everybody got onto the field of play.
And well, they certainly did in 68, I can assure you of that, and they did in 72.
Wonderful. So leading up to the games, do you remember hearing anything about possible boycotts or protests, or remember reading anything about an Olympic Project for Human Rights?
Oh, that whole scenario was a bunch of bullshit, and I, you know, to this day, I'm embarrassed by what took place down there. A lot of people would disagree with me, but I didn't think it was the proper venue to do that kind of thing. They later have erected a statue of the two or three guys with the black glove salute at San Jose State, and that embarrasses me too, because that was, you know, my alma mater. And you know, it's not that I disagreed with their ideas or anything. I just didn't think that was the proper time or the place to do it. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And I can recall a guy by the name of Will Grimsley, who wrote for the NEA at the time. I think it was the NEA. It was like AP and Reuters are today. And I was about a door or two down from Peyton Jordan, the track coach, and this guy came up and started knocking on the door, screaming he wanted an interview. And Peyton Jordan wouldn't answer the door. And it got so raucous that I had to go out of my room and, you know, confront the guy. And I said, hey, look, well, he was drunk on his butt. And I said, you know, obviously he doesn't want to talk to you, so why don't you turn around and go down? I was really upset. I almost wanted to throw him down the stairs because we were on the second floor. And he finally relented and went downstairs. I didn't know Peyton Jordan at the time, but then about 5 years later, I was hired at Stanford, and that's where Peyton worked, and we got to be very good friends, and I saw Peyton every day. But at the time, I didn't know him, except to say hello.
Yeah. So did that incident happen in the Olympic Village or in the training camp?
No, that happened in the Olympics itself.
Oh, wow. Hmm. So
the main concern when we went down there was that Mexico City was having problems. There were riots and so forth. And when we arrived there, there were all kinds of soldiers with, you know, armed with weapons all over the place, because they didn't want any, you know, any protesters getting into the games or anything else. It was quite a unique thing, and that seemed to be the primary focus, the civil rights thing. At least in my memory, the civil rights thing didn't rear its, the black glove salute and all that BS didn't come together until sometime during the Olympics itself.
Mm-hmm. Prior to the Olympics, did you remember receiving a letter from the Harvard crew team about anything related to the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
No. Mm. I didn't.
Do you remember?
I may have gotten one, but I sure don't recall it.
Yeah. Do you remember hearing or seeing anything on the news or reading anything in the newspapers about the Mexico City student riots?
The Mexico City student riots? Yeah, we read about those as before we went down there.
Uh-huh. And I guess I should say student demonstrations. But how were they portrayed in the American media, or how did you perceive them in the American media at the time?
Well, I think in the American media, they're just portrayed as you know, just typical things that you see today. Somebody's protesting, and being that it was Mexico, and the Mexico City students were protesting, that's their business, not ours. I didn't pay much attention to it, except that I knew it was there, and then when we got there, we saw the army out all around. To prevent the protesters from affecting the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Mexican student protesters.
And had you heard about any violence or anybody being killed or shot before you got
there? Yeah, as I recall, there were. I think it was in the paper.
And how did you feel about arriving in Mexico then when you heard about that?
Well, I think, the assurances that were made by the Mexican Olympic Committee that everything was fine and safe. And as it turned out, it was. It was a wonderful Olympics. It really was.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever they did, I'm not quite sure exactly what it was, but whatever they did, the protests either died or were contained.
Okay. Well, what were your impressions then of Mexico City and its people itself?
Mexico City was huge. It had a tremendous amount of air pollution. The people were wonderful. I was fairly fluent at that point in Spanish, so that helped a lot when we went outside the village to eat or anything, They have marvelous restaurants in Mexico City,
mm-hmm.
or did. I thoroughly enjoyed the experience. We had actually, I just remembered, we'd actually gone down there and played in a preliminary tournament in Mexico City about 2 weeks before the games themselves. So I was somewhat familiar with the city, if one could be familiar with something like that over, a short period of time, because it is huge.
Mm-hmm. Did you go down there, play in the preliminary tournament, and then come back to the States?
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
Came back to the Air Force Academy.
Oh, okay. So you ventured out into the city, it sounds like, a little bit, and did some sightseeing and ate at some restaurants.
Well, you had the time in the 68 Olympics to do that, Desiree,
mm-hmm.
compared to what they do now, as I understand it. You play your venue and you're through.
Mm.
So you can opt to go home, or you can stay if you want, but there's no real reason to stay except to just sort of enjoy the Olympics, I guess. Because if you know people playing in other venues, if they're playing at the same time you're playing, they're going to be through too. Whereas in 68, you'd had a day or two off, you'd have some practice time in the pool, and then your players would be, they go out and watch other Olympic events and talk with other athletes, and I would go with other coaches, and we might go out outside the village to have dinner or something like that.
Yeah.
I certainly liked that a lot better than I did the way they're doing it now.
Yeah, it sounds like you had some pretty memorable times and interactions.
Oh, we did. I mean, I met a lot of people and watched a lot of things that I wouldn't have been able to see otherwise, and I ended up watching a lot of the men's volleyball tournament, and where we beat the Russians in five games, and they were the top team in the world. One of my teammates in water polo, believe it or not, in San Jose State, was the captain of the volleyball team.
Oh, wow.
And so he and I got together. I don't know if you remember a name called Perry O'Brien, shot putter.
That one's not familiar to me right now.
Well, anyway, we got together with him and had a cup of tea and had dinner. He knew Tom Hain really well, my teammate. So, that was just an opportunity, and I got to know a lot of the guys on that team, whereas prior I didn't. And of course, I knew Tom because he was a former teammate, but I didn't know the other guys, and to this day, I'm still in touch with a couple of them.
From the volleyball team?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how neat.
Of course, I ended up, you know, my last coaching stint at Notre Dame, I was coaching women's volleyball.
Oh, how neat.
So I sort of morphed into, after I got out of water polo, and we won the national champion NCAA title at Stanford in 1976. I went on to go from De'Anza, I went to Stanford. And after that, the AD came up and said, you know, there's not much more you can do in water polo. You've coached in two Olympic Games, blah, 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 Pan American Games, what have you. And he said, why don't you get, because I had a volleyball background. I had played a lot on the beach. And he had asked me to take over the men's team,
mm-hmm.
club team. We did very, very well. And then he said, why don't you coach women's volleyball? Well, that conflicted with water polo because they're both fall sports. So I made the decision to get into volleyball and started coaching women at Stanford and then ended up coaching women at Notre Dame.
You've had a pretty amazing coaching career as well.
It's been a good ride.
Yeah, definitely. So going back to Mexico City, just a few more specific questions about, you know, what that experience was like. So did you or anyone you know get any foodborne illness?
Did I what?
Did you or anyone you know get any foodborne illness while you were there?
No. Oh, you know, we were told, you know, you don't want to get Montezuma's revenge. So
yeah.
That just comes from drinking the water and eating off the streets and being careful that you don't eat a lot of raw food. No, I don't think anybody got the trots, if you want to call them that, or whatever.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good.
I think everything turned out pretty well that way.
Yeah.
As I can recall, I don't know, maybe somebody did, I don't know.
Yeah.
I know in subsequent trips when I was coaching the national team and we were traveling through Europe, yeah, we had all kinds of problems with that, especially when we got into the old Soviet Union. But not, I don't recall it being a problem in Mexico City.
Huh. So really, some people got sick when you went into the Soviet Union?
Oh, yeah. Oh, big time. I can give you a couple of stories, but I don't think they'd be good for public notice.
Oh.
It gets down to the basic bathroom humor is what it does.
Oh, gosh. That must have been rough.
All the attendant problems or something like that.
Yeah. So what were your impressions of security measures in Mexico City during the games? Or
I thought they were pretty good, mm-hmm. actually. I mean, I certainly had no problems with it. You know, the soldiers were there. They were nice. They were located pretty much out of view. You knew they were there, but they weren't a presence where you were affected visually all the time. At least I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
They were up in the sides of the hills and things like that.
So what were the local Mexican people like at the games when they
were? Oh, they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely great. In fact, we weren't in those days, and coaches in 1968 Olympics weren't allowed to march in. And so I was up in the stands with a couple of the other coaches, and we watched our team march in, and then I looked, and there were about 400 other guys marching in that weren't athletes, that were just, you know, supporters that, you know, that were on this Olympic committee or on that committee or something. And I went, biggest bunch of crap I've heard in a long time here. The coaches are putting the time and effort in and not getting paid. These dingleberries are marching in. I was very upset with that. But anyway, that aside, I went up and I saw this little old man, I'd say two-thirds of the way up the stadium. And he had this camera. It was an old camera, and it was on a 360-degree swivel, and it had serrated deals that it would rotate on. So it would move an inch, or not an inch, it would move a 16th, a 16th, a 16th, a 16th, a 16th. And so he started that thing way over on the left side where they were marching in, and he went all the way through, so you got the whole thing. Then he put it all together. Well, I gave him my name and address and spoke to him in Spanish. And he sent me a picture, which I still have today, which is framed and mounted in my den here. of the 68 Olympic Games. It's a wide angle deal. It gets the whole spectrum. It was unbelievable.
How amazing.
Yeah, it was good.
So what was your impression of your accommodations at the Olympic Village itself? Like, what was your room like?
A typical, you know, Spartan, the bed and a small dresser and a, you know, a bath and a shower. You know, nothing. It was Spartan, but nobody gave a damn. I mean, nobody was out there for, you know, had beach towels and were going to the beach and wanted all the amenities. You know, you're just glad to be in the Olympic Games.
Right. And did you stay with your team, or were you in an area with a bunch of other coaches?
No, we were with our team. We weren't in the same room, but, I mean, you know, the team, two or three guys to a room down the hall, so to speak.
Okay.
So we're all on the same floor and everything. But the coaches had their room.
And this is where Peyton Jordan was just a few doors down from you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you didn't get to march in the opening ceremony, but what... Aside from being upset about that, what were your impressions of the opening ceremony?
Oh, they were great. They were wonderful. It was very colorful. This is my first time ever. And they were very comfortable. I really enjoyed watching them. I would have preferred to have marched in because, you know, I was proud of our country and proud to be a member of the Olympic team. I got that opportunity in 72 because then coaches did march.
Hmm.
Prior to that, they didn't.
Well, I'm glad they changed it.
Well, so am I.
So was there anybody on... You already talked about Tom Payne and O'Brien, but was there anyone else on the team with whom you were particularly close?
No, I'm not really particularly close. I had met Ralph Boston, the broad jumper, when in the Pan American Games.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I think. And so I saw him, and I was happened to run into him where we all ate, you know, the mess hall.
Mm-hmm.
After he had lost the broad jump, or long jump, now it's called, to, what was the guy's name that jumped out of the gym? I can't think of it now. Set a new world record.
Beeman?
Yeah, Beeman. And in fact, one of my players and I we had an off day and we were watching the track and the long jump, and Beeman came down and hit the board, took off, and it showed up on the scoreboard in meters. And the boy I was with, the player I was with, was excellent in math. And he converted it immediately, and he says, "My God, Coach, that's 29-plus feet." And I said, "Nah." I said, you know, Boston was at 27.8, 27.9, and they were trying to get to 28 feet. And here Beeman just obliterates it and goes 29 feet. By golly, it stood up. So I happened to be in the mess hall afterwards, and I saw Ralph over there, and I went over and sat down. I said, "Geez, sorry, you know, I had a tray in my hand," and I said, "Sorry." He says, "That's the way it goes, Art." He was pretty down. He said, "You know, the most difficult part of it is that, you know, here we're all struggling to get from 27, 8, 9, 10, or 11 into the 28s in feet, and this guy just avoids the whole thing and goes 29 feet." And I said, "Yeah." And other than that, you know, it was one of the real great memories I have of the Olympics was watching Beeman make that jump. I was only about 15 feet away from it.
Oh, wow. So you saw it in person. That's amazing. That's really amazing. Most of the people I've talked to saw it on one of the TVs that they had where people could watch in the Olympic Village, and very few people actually got to see it in person.
Uh-huh. No, we were right there.
That's amazing.
Right across the track. You know.
Mm-hmm. So do you
the whole thing.
Do you think you and your team got to see a little bit more of the Olympics and go to some of the other events more than maybe other teams or coaches got to?
No question. I mean, you mean compared to other Olympics or that one?
In that one.
No, because everybody had time off.
Okay.
So other teams and other coaches would mosey around. I know we had players and athletes from other venues come and watch us play. You know, I think that's why they call it the Friendly Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Because there was...
Because you got to know other people, and you got to go and watch and talk to them and so forth.
But then compared to other Olympics, you were saying it wasn't that way?
No, it wasn't. 72 wasn't that way at all.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was colored by all of the Arab-Israeli problem, but basically, that was what I call up the floor and out the door. You played every day, finished, and that was it. So you really didn't have a chance unless you wanted to hang around. But a lot of, most people didn't hang around. They had other things to do, you know, businesses to attend to. They had jobs, so they didn't stick around.
Hmm.
Took off after their venue was over.
Wow. So, did you have any interactions or remember meeting any of the female team members?
As what?
Did you meet any of the female team members from the U.S.
Oh, sure. I knew a lot of the female women volleyball players from the Pan Am Games.
Okay.
And that was basically the same group that represented us in 68 in the Olympics. And so I knew them. I knew a couple of track gals. I just went to an awards banquet last week, and they showed a picture of me with Francie Leroux, who was our cross-country runner then.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Francie was from, I think she was from the Bay Area, San Jose State, somewhere in there. Anyway, somebody set us up, took a picture of us, and I know it was her because she was so short.
So, being a coach, you know, very recently of women's athletics, how would you compare what women's athletics was or you know, women's sports, women's Olympic sports were back then in 68 compared to now? What are some of the major differences?
Oh, Desiree, it's the difference between night and day.
Oh, really?
You had the gals back then, you know, for them to compete in the Olympics wasn't, it wasn't as acceptable as it is today. Well, you're a woman athlete, you know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it's completely the opposite. I mean, I watch as much women's volleyball on TV as I do men. I watch as much women's golf as I do men's golf. Just gals are good. They're finally having an opportunity to play. I know one of the big regrets that my wife has, is that, and she's a damn good athlete, is that they didn't have any opportunities for them when she was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's in her 70s now, and, you know, she's about 5 years younger than I am. And, I mean, then it was just, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it was called GAA, Girls Athletic Association. You know, and they'd play intramurally and put on their ugly uniforms and go out and play and then have tea afterwards, you know. So it's changed. And so here you find, you know, the 68 Olympic women's volleyball team in 68, you find them and you say, I mean, these girls were really bucking the odds.
Yeah.
But nowadays it's 180 degrees different. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So how did people view the female athletes back then, and how were they treated back then?
Well, I think by those that were involved in the Olympics, I think they were treated exactly the same. I mean, you know, just a lot of admiration, hats off to them for doing what they were doing. I mean, no, I don't think people thought any other way. Those that were competing, I think the problem had to do with the administrators and the general public at large.
Yeah.
You know, that was the main focus. I mean, the guys that were playing and they saw women playing it, to them it was just fun to watch. It was great.
Yeah. So do you remember the gender verification tests?
Do I remember the what?
The gender verification tests that the women had to take?
No, I don't. You know, I obviously wasn't paying that much attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only time I've heard about it was recently, within the last 3 or 4 years, there was one that was considered to be a male that was playing in a female. I, don't even know if they had that then, did they?
Yes, 1968 was the first year that it was introduced as a standard procedure.
Well, you know, gender verification tests, I never, in 68, I don't ever recall them.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you.
Yeah. Did you, since you were there watching the opening ceremonies, do you remember seeing the first woman to ever light the torch in the cauldron ceremony?
No, honestly, I don't. I was sitting next to one of our divers, Mickey King.
Oh, yes.
Who, for some reason, was not on the parade. I can't remember why she wasn't. I think she got in late, or I don't know what the story was. But I had never met her before, and I ended up sitting next to her. And so we watched the opening ceremonies together.
That's neat. We actually did an interview with Mickey a few months back.
Uh-huh.
And we'll have that one up on our website soon. We need to have her review the interview first, but that's a neat connection.
She was a great gal. In fact, that was the Olympics where she broke her arm on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And she was out.
That was a tough story, tough to hear.
Oh, yeah. But by golly, she came back and won it in 72, I think, or something like that. I can't remember right now.
Yes, she did. She did. And did you happen to witness that in 72?
Yes, I did.
Wonderful. It's neat how that worked out. So tell me a little about your interaction with some of the other national teams. For example, interaction with the Soviet athletes and the East German athletes.
Well, those were all good. I guess the one salient point that comes back to me over and over again was, and it sort of crippled my ideal of the Olympics, is when we were offered a bribe to have our official throw a game for another team and they'd take care of us, you know. We were lined up outside the water polo stadium, or the swim stadium, and one of the Italian officials came up to me and said, "Art, can I talk to you for a moment?" And I said, "Sure." And so he was one of the administrators, not a coach, but I guess the chef de mission, or whatever you want to call it. And he said, "Could we talk to your referee? Each team brings its own referee. If your referee will give us a good result in the match we're about to play, our referee will give you a good result in your..." I went, "Huh?" I said, "No." I said, "I really don't think so." And I was absolutely, I probably was slack-jawed and dumbfounded, as I recall now, because it stands out in my mind. And, you know, here you've got this Olympic ideal, and you've listened to Brundage and all this kind of stuff. Then some guy comes over and does that, and you go, "Wait a minute, this is the real world here."
Wow. So this was an Italian administrator?
Well, whoever the head of the Italian water polo delegation was, I don't know, I can't even remember his name right now. Of course, I remember the incident very clearly.
Wow. And how did he act during that interchange? Did he seem to think that this was a normal mode of business?
No, I was trying to be polite. I felt like telling him he was full of shit, but and I wouldn't do that. But I didn't. I held my tongue and said, "I don't think that's necessary that we do that." I said, "You better find another coach or another country that would do that." And, of course, that threw my antenna up for anything suspicious for the rest of that tournament.
And was there anything suspicious?
I beg your pardon?
Was there anything else suspicious for the rest
of the tournament? Not that I could tell, no.
Okay.
Water polo is a very subjective game in terms of its officiating. So as a result of that, probably a third of the game is above the water and the other two-thirds are below. So there's a lot of places where you can get subjective in your officiating. And you can actually absolutely affect the outcome of a game.
Hmm. But you don't feel that anything like that untoward took place?
I didn't see anything after that, and I was looking for it when we were playing in the World Championships in Yugoslavia in 1971. I saw a blatant example of it, but nothing in the 68 Olympics past that. I guess what happened was that particular instance put me on the alert.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, you know, what was going on.
Definitely. So what was the one blatant example that you witnessed in Yugoslavia?
Oh, well, it gets into water polo, but, you know, water polo, I don't know if you're familiar with it enough, or with ice hockey, you have power plays where you have an extra man or an extra player. You know, somebody's ejected until a goal is scored or for a specified period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching we placed third in the world that year, and I was watching the Yugoslavians, then Yugoslavia, play the Soviets. The Soviets had a great goalie. The Yugoslavians were awarded something like 15 kickouts. They had 15 extra men, and this Russian goalie just played out of his head. Out of his mind, I guess, and blocked almost all of their extra men. The Russians were given 2 kickouts, and they lost to the Yugos 2-1. And the official was a guy from Spain, Mongio. And Mongio had been hired by the Yugos to come and work the tournament, among other referees.
Hmm.
And the tournament was held in Yugoslavia, and it was the most one-sided, you know, and of course he'd been hired by the Yugos to come and work the tournament, and he had their game at that point, and so he wanted to return the favor for having been asked to come to Yugoslavia, so he took care of the Yugos. And after the game was over, one of the other officials from France, Angela, came by me. I was sitting in about the fifth row up from the pool deck. There's about 3,000 or 4,000 fans there. And he comes over and he's audit. He says, "What you think?" And I said, "That was terrible." And he says, "Audit." He says, "Specialty de Europa." You know, a special from Europe.
Wow.
I mean, you know, and it is even to this day, from what I can gather, I haven't seen a lot of water polo lately, but it was, even to this day, it's one of the problems in the game.
Gosh. Well, speaking of the Soviets and problems in water polo, do you recall the 1956 match in the Melbourne Olympics between the Soviets and Hungary?
I don't necessarily recall it, Desiree, but I remember reading about it in those days because we didn't have it on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't. We when I was at San Jose State, we played that team that toured, came to the United States and toured.
Mm-hmm.
And two or three of those players defected and stayed in the United States. One or two of them were my teammates on the Olympic Club team that won the national championship that I was telling you about, you know, as players. And the other one was my coach on that team for 1 year.
Really?
So we got, you know, and the guy that had the cut over his eye, his old Irvin Zadar, became a very popular restaurateur and owned a couple of restaurants in San Francisco. I don't know where he is today, to be honest with you.
Hmm. So you got to know those players from Russia a little bit, or from, I
right.
guess, Soviet
we
Union.
Did, from Hungary.
Oh, from Hungary. It was the Hungarian team that toured. The
Hungarians that, you know, and that was right after that uprising in Hungary.
Okay, so it was the Hungarians
that the Russians brutally put down.
Right. So the Hungarian team is the one that toured, and those are the team members that you got to know, and the coach, the one that was a coach for your team for 1 year.
That's correct.
Okay. And what was it like to get to know them?
Oh, great. They're great people. In fact, I saw one or two of them at the reunion that we had of our national championship teams in 57-59. We had a reunion this past year in September.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And saw them again, and I've seen a couple of those guys almost every other year. That's great.
Mm-hmm. So did they ever talk about that match, the 56 match?
You mean the one in Australia?
Yes.
No, not really. It's old news.
Yeah.
You know, it's been beaten about so many times. Guys just, enough.
Yeah.
I guess. You know, it doesn't come up anymore. It used to, but not now.
When it used to come up, what would they say about it? Do you remember talking to any of them about it back in...
Yeah, they obviously disliked the Russians, because the Russians were the ones that brutally put them down.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, politics carried right over into the water on those ones and that one.
Hmm. So after you read about it and after the team toured and you met some of them, do you remember any conversations about it that stand out in your mind?
Not really. It had been expressed pretty much in the newspapers quite a bit.
Yeah.
And, a lot of those guys that defected stayed and played on the Olympic Club team, and we would work out with them and against them. And, you know, some of them were teammates, some weren't. But, no, I don't know that it... No, I think they were just relieved to... I mean, I think the one expression that they had was the amount of food that was available in this country. They'd never seen a supermarket before.
Oh, wow.
And they walked in and took a look at the food and thing and went, holy Toledo, Art, why, how come I've never seen so much food? You know, because they didn't have a lot of food back in those days.
That's
and, really... That almost everybody that I met who came over, I mean, water polo served a great purpose for me, just meeting all these people from different, you know, countries. And I had another fellow come over that I co-sponsored and from Yugoslavia, and he immediately put on 40 pounds. He says, I just can't believe the amount of food that's available here. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's everywhere you turn. There's two or three supermarkets in one town.
That's amazing. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so... you know, I don't know that people realize in this country just how damn fortunate we are.
Right. It does make you wonder.
Yeah.
And thankful, too.
It should be.
Mm-hmm. So, did you have any interactions with athletes from the Soviet bloc during the 68 games?
You know, not that I can recall. Basically... you have to understand then, back in 68, the Cold War was on, and they were sort of a cloistered group, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, the Spanish, the Italians, the Hungarians, all a little bit different. Like we played the East Germans, I never got to know anybody on the East German team.
Hmm.
Never got to know anybody on the Soviet team. In subsequent years, I did, but not at the 68 Olympics because, you know, everything, they were closely watched. They didn't want any defections,
Yeah.
Subsequently, I found out that all of these guys on that team, as I got to know them over the years, they all had Swiss bank accounts. So when they went... But, you know, when they'd get out of the country, and any monies they'd have, they put it in the Swiss account. I mean, they were pretty sharp.
That's very interesting. So
yeah.
They were being watched, but they found some way to subvert that system.
Apparently, yeah. Because I remember over the years, early 70s and mid-70s, talking with two or three of them that I got to know pretty well, and the idea of having a Swiss bank account was not uncommon at all.
That's very interesting. So you mentioned that you guys played the East German team. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and how you perceived them as the East German team, or how they were known as the East German team?
Well, just as what they were the East German team. They didn't really say much. They weren't overly friendly. They weren't rude. They're just kept to themselves. They're an excellent team. I was quite thrilled when we beat them because they were considered one of the top three teams in the world at that time.
Right.
And whether they were on dope and steroids and all the stuff that plagued the East German swimming team in latter years, I don't know. I have no idea. But no incidents, nothing stands out in my mind about that except that we did beat them.
That you did beat them.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty amazing considering, you know, what their I guess, reputation was at the time. So
we had probably, I don't know, that we had a kid in on that team that was over, I think the goalie was in his mid-20s, Van Dorp, and I think the rest of the team, I don't think, was over 22 years old. And we're playing against guys that are obviously being subsidized by the state, contrary to Brundage's idea of amateurism. And they were all in their either late 20s or early 30s.
And how did you feel about that? How did you feel about the?
Well, I feel like didn't feel like we were playing with a full deck. I mean, I thought it was not a level playing field.
So you think it gave them an unfair advantage?
Oh, sure. Well, yes. That was these were pros. Behind the Iron Curtain, these were pros. This was their main job.
Yeah.
And our deal, no, we had to make a living and then practice. You know, make a living someplace else.
Mm-hmm. So, do you remember hearing any rumors about doping, or did you have any?
No, I really didn't. I don't think that really came to the fore until, you know, later years.
Okay.
I mean, I don't recall anybody talking about doping. I think the first time it was exposed in athletics was with the East German women on the swim team, if I remember correctly.
So the East Germans, did you also play the West German team, or was there...
Yes, we played the West German team,
And so what was the difference, if you were to look at the teams, what was the difference visually as far as uniforms or colors or how they comported themselves?
Well, you're talking about a different culture, completely. The West Germans were outgoing, friendly people. East Germans equaled their Soviet counterparts in Russia. Everything they wear, when I was in Russia and the Soviet Union, which I was there two or three times, everything's dark, dark suits, dark gray, dark blue, black, occasional pinstripe. You'd walk down the streets and they would... You'd say, I got to a point where I'm walking down the street, and I just say, hi, how are you, with a big smile, and sort of look at you with this frown on their face and keep going. They're very dour people, and the East Germans were the same way. I was, 1965, I was in East Germany on a consulting thing, and it was the same way. Everything was just drab. You know, the landscape was drab. The people were dour. I remember taking over kids in 76. Took the Stanford team over to Russia. But before, the Berlin Wall fell. And those days, we student riots. We had quite a few liberals on the team. When they came back, they're pretty conservative. you know, see the difference in the in what socialism and communism has done to a people.
Yeah.
Something else.
So what was the difference between the East German and West German uniforms then in 68? Did they have...
Well, if I can recall, I think the East Germans were pretty drab, you know, where the colorful stuff of the red, orange, red, yellow, or orange, and yellow, whatever it is, I can't remember. I mean, you know, colors are in the eye of the beholder, but the West Germans, just a whole different outlook. Completely, and it's expressed in their facial, it's expressed in their body language, it's expressed in their choice of uniforms, colors, and so forth. I'll give you a classic example. Everything in Moscow back then, like I said, was gray, dark gray, black, or very dark blue, with drab ties. And as you moved west out towards what was then Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg, the closer you got to the coast, the more open the people were, and the colors of their clothes changed conspicuously.
Mm-hmm.
So, because they were influenced by, and St. Petersburg, you're right on the Baltic Sea there, so you've got the influence of seaport, you've got the influence of a lot of other cultures coming and going.
Yeah.
But you can see the difference, and it was evident to all of our kids.
Yeah.
So, in answer to your question, yeah, the East Germans were, you know, a little different that way.
And the reason I was asking is, in some sources I've read that the East German team was not officially recognized as a separate team in 1968, but then most of the athletes who were actually there that I've talked to, and most of the results, the ranking and results from those games, do show that there was indeed an entirely separate East German team. So I just
wonder. Well, there were. They were. I don't give a damn what the media or the politicians say. The East Germans were a separate team.
Okay.
They were not combined with the West Germans. I mean, it wasn't the unified German team that was playing. It's like the North Koreans and South Koreans. It's two separate entities.
Okay. So did they march in together or under the same flag, or did they have two separate flags?
They had two separate flags.
Okay.
Separately.
And what about anthems? Do you remember if the anthems were different during the medal ceremonies? If you happen to...
I can't remember specifically, but I'd be willing to bet you 100% that they were.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. Well, thank you for clearing that up. It's some of the...
I remember all the controversy about that. The East Germans absolutely refused to be confused with the West Germans. I mean, this was a absolute no-no, you know. They were their own outfit, their own entity.
Okay. So you guys defeated East Germany, and your ranking was fifth in the final?
I believe so.
And the winners, Hungary and the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, is that correct?
You know, Desiree, I don't know. I can't remember who won the gold, whether it was the Yugos or the Hungarians or the Russians. I know there were 1, 2, 3 somewhere in there.
Yeah. Did you witness any of those games?
I think the Italians were probably fourth or third. We were fifth.
Oh, okay. Well, now, the Italians coming out just ahead of you guys, were you suspicious at all having that one administrator approach you like that?
Was I suspicious of what?
Of the Italians coming out ahead.
Well, you know, you're always in the back of your mind, after having been confronted with that, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, I wonder who paid off who here, you know?
Mm.
But it's one of the things that you just dealt with. Subsequently, in international competition, I just assumed that, you know, we had to be a couple of goals ahead so that you don't let the referee make, you know, change the game on you.
Mm.
Take him out of the game.
Right. So did you or did anyone from your team have to undergo any testing for banned or performance-enhancing substances?
Not that I recall. I mean, there was no urine test that I can recall, anything like that. You know, nobody was peeing in a bottle after you're through. But I recall, I don't know whether other people associated with the 68 Olympics said there was. I don't know, but I don't recall that.
As the coach, did you ever receive a notice or a memorandum about what they might be testing for or if they might be testing?
No, not that I can recall.
Was there ever a list of banned substances that you had to be aware of?
No, I never saw it. I mean, I think if there were a list of banned substances, I'm sure I would remember receiving that. But I don't recall receiving anything like that.
Okay. And did you happen to witness the salute, the Smith and Carlos salute?
Or? No, I didn't. Obviously, I heard about it. I think we were playing that day.
Oh.
You know, and I heard all about the black glove salute and all that, and I thought, you know, this is not appropriate at that point. Not that I disagreed with what they were doing, but I just didn't think it was appropriate.
And just, I'm not questioning your feelings about it, but can you describe to me why you thought it was an inappropriate venue?
Well, I figured that, you know, to take the politics out of it. I mean, we got enough problems with politics in the world even then, like we do now. And to use sports to push your political agenda, I thought was whatever it might be, civil rights, whatever, you know, oppression, whatever. You know, the other side of the coin is people will say, well, it's a great platform in which to express your displeasure. What the hell? After, you know, you keep doing that line of thinking, and pretty soon you lose the essence of what the tournament or the sports is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was not happy with that at all. And I wouldn't have been happy with anybody demonstrating, whether they student protesters, Occupy Wall Street. Let's just keep that out of the games. It's not necessary to keep it in there. That's all.
What were some of the people around you saying, or what were some of the other reactions around you?
I don't recall what the reactions of our players were. I think they were more surprised than anything. I know that the coaches that I spoke with were heavily against it. I know Peyton didn't like it at all. But, of course, he was directly affected because he was the head coach of the track team.
Mm-hmm. So that person who was banging on his door and trying to get an interview, who was that person again?
Will Grimsley, Grimsley.
And he was from which organization?
Well, I think it was some news organization. I think it was the NEA or something like that. I might have that wrong. You could Google him up and Wikipedia him and find out.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like AP, Reuters, you know, that INS right now. I don't know if it still exists or not.
And he was just trying to get a media interview with Peyton Jordan?
Trying to get an interview, and he kept banging on the door and banging on the door, and he was drunk. And I finally had to step out and said, you know, there's other people trying to go to sleep here. And I said, I don't particularly give a damn whether you can get an interview or not. Obviously, he doesn't want you to, so get out of here. I sort of halfway escorted him down the stairs.
Right. So was there a big fallout from the media after that?
I don't recall. Of course, we were in a very low-profile media situation. Water polo is not one of your high-profile deals like track and field is or basketball is or something like that. So I don't know that there was any fallout after that.
What are your memories of the media at the 68 games? What do you remember about TV or cameras or journalists?
You know, Desiree, not much. I don't think I can be of much help there. Like I say, we weren't covered like covered. So I don't. I don't really recall the media being a factor, except for the black glove salute. You know.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the media had an effect on that situation? And if so, what was that effect?
Oh, sure, they had an effect on it. You know, they blasted it throughout the world. You know, and everybody invade their opinion one way or the other, you know, and of course now it's, you know, they're looked upon as heroes by some, certainly not like by me, but you know, that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Well, do you have any other memorable moments from those games that stand out in your mind? Any other events that you witnessed or interactions that you had?
No, I think basically, you know, we've covered it. I just, how much I enjoyed those Olympics more than the 72 Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know players and athletes from other disciplines and how great that was. You know, it was my first experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, outside of the Pan American Games, it was my first experience with basically, you know, international competition.
And did you attend the closing ceremonies? Did you watch those?
I believe I did. Yes.
Uh-huh. And what were your thoughts or feelings then?
Well, I thought it was wonderful. I'm trying to remember who led the closing ceremonies for us. I can't remember offhand, but you know, it was the full thing, the full gesture of, you know, the camaraderie expressed by the athletes for one another, and I thought it was pretty good. I was impressed.
And what did you do right after the games closed?
Came home, had to go back to work.
Uh-huh. So you didn't get any time off?
Nope, none.
And what was the reaction of your friends and family and coworkers when you returned?
They were all for it. And I said, well, next time, I said, you can carry my bags and go in my place, you know, because living out of a suitcase for that long a period of time, and as I did subsequently many years up until the late 70s, you know, people say, well, oh, God, that sounds great. And I said, well, it is, but there's a downside to it, too. You know, it's just, you know, you learn. I've got, I got 6 or 7 passports here that are all stamped and full. You know, it's my wife now says to me, she says, you know, she wants to travel, and she says, you don't want to travel. I said, no, I had enough.
It sounds like you got to travel an immense amount during your career.
I did. You know, I was basically all over the world. The only place I wasn't was in Africa.
Hmm. What was your favorite place that you visited?
The Ligurian coast in Italy.
Oh, really? Why is
Genoa south down to La Spezia. You know, down that, well, the Ligurian coast, you know, right there, Santa Margherita, Portofino.
Ah.
Second place would probably be Berlin.
And why is that?
Oh, I don't know. Every time we'd come out, I think every time we'd come out of the Soviet Union, we'd end up in Berlin or someplace in Germany, and it would be like coming home because you'd have normal breakfasts, and, you know, it was more like home than, you know, in the Soviet Union, you had general fare was mystery meat and potatoes. Nobody knew what the mystery meat was. I don't know. It was veal. I don't know, but you could hardly find it. And in the mornings for breakfast, you'd have juice and rolls with jam on them. Mm-hmm. That was breakfast.
Hmm.
That's why they call it a continental breakfast, Desiree.
Yeah.
I mean, cereal and things like that just weren't known in those areas, whereas when you got to Germany, they were.
Yeah. So,
and Berlin is a, you know, a very exciting city. It was. I'm sure it is now, too, but it's a wonderful. You want to get citified and everything, that's the place to go.
Sounds fun. So, looking back on your career, how do you think, or what do you think the impact of water polo and your experiences in both Olympic Games, what do you think the impact of this was on your life, and how would your life be different without those experiences?
Oh, the impact on my life was huge, Desiree. I mean, huge. You know, just from the fact that somebody says, you were an Olympic coach, and of course that gives you entree to things that you normally wouldn't get an entree to. It's changed my life significantly. Coaching internationally and coaching into Olympic Games, Pan American Games, and all of that was a highlight of my life.
Mm.
But, you know, my birth of my kids and my wife, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a career thing.
Yeah. So, looking back, you already mentioned some things about amateurism, but what were your personal experiences early on with eligibility rules or trying to find a means of support for the sport? And how would you compare your early experiences to the amateur experience today?
Well, right now everything's professional. You know, they're taking pro basketball players. I mean, we're on an equal basis now. Whereas before, with the socialist countries, we weren't. They were employed, quote unquote, full time playing their sport and getting paid for it. We weren't. You know, we were trying to. I think the height of hypocrisy was Brundage saying, "Well, we're the same as they are because some of our athletes are getting full time scholarships at universities, and so therefore they're getting paid." And I said, "You know, Brundage, that's a crock. You know, these guys are fully employed. That's all they do for a living. If we have in college when." You know, you're getting a full ride, yes, but you're also, your main job is to get an education. It may not be that way with basketball or football, but it certainly is in all the other sports. And so I always felt that we were at a distinct disadvantage there because, you know, like I said, I never got a nickel, neither did any of my players.
Mm-hmm. So we were at a disadvantage in the early days, but not now.
Yeah, and I think when Peter Ubroth came in and ran the Olympics in 1984, I think that whole thing changed.
And how do you feel about that change, aside from...
I think it's great. In fact, I just saw Peter the other night. He was a former teammate of mine at San Jose State. We played together for 2 or 3 years. I'm still in touch with him.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So, and he did a great job in 1984 of putting the money back into the sport governing bodies.
Mm.
Which I thought was a great move.
And you talked a little bit about some comparisons between 68 and 72 as far as the level of interaction with other teams and being able to go see some of the other events. But
well, there wasn't any interaction with other teams because you didn't have a chance. You started playing on Monday and you played Tuesday, you played Wednesday, you played Thursday, you played Friday, you played Saturday, and you were through.
And then you went home.
And well, or you could stay, but most people, given the option, you know, went home, especially with the Arab-Israeli conflict. You know, I watched that from around the corner, watched the whole thing. Then I had to catch a plane. The security was unbelievable, and especially after that.
Can you tell me a little bit about those games and the things that really stick out in your mind?
What, 72?
Yes.
Well, obviously, I remember us winning the bronze medal. I remember very well watching George Haynes, the Santa Clara Swim Club coach, who was coach of the men and women's swim team, whom I knew pretty well because we were both from the same area and used to compete against each other when we were coaching in high school. I was walking out, and he says, "Hey, Artie, come over here and look." We peered around the corner, and that's when we sat and stood and watched all of this thing unfold. And I guess that's then my leaving about 3 hours later and catching a Pan Am flight home, and the security at the airport was absolutely incredible. So that sort of overrode everything else except for our getting the bronze medal.
Describe that moment.
What, getting the bronze?
Yes.
Well, very proud. Actually thought we could have gotten the gold and the silver, and but for a couple of missteps, we probably could have. But basically, very proud. The first medal won by the United States in water polo on foreign soil.
That is amazing.
In the Olympics.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So what part did you see unfolding of that conflict that took place there? Was it
well, basically what you saw in newsreels and everything else, people moving out around the outside of the building, up in the balcony, and, you know, with their weapons and so forth. Obviously, we didn't see inside because there's no TV cameras inside.
Right. So what were your feelings? Were you pretty, you know, disturbed or scared?
Oh, yeah. I was absolutely, you know, just very mad. Very mad. I mean, there's just no excuse for that. You talk about politicizing the games. It makes the black glove salute seem tame. I mean, you know, those Israelis that lost their life in that.
Yeah, yeah. So, why do you think the 68 games were an important moment in history or in the history of the Olympics?
Why do I what now, dear?
What reasons or for what reasons do you think the 68 games were an important moment in Olympic history?
Well, as it turns out, I think it was the last one that where you had your venue ran the entire length of the Olympic Games, and you had a chance to get out and see other people, see other teams play, make friends, so forth. I don't think anymore you have those options. I think they run the venues one right after, you know, your venue runs. I know I'm repeating myself here, but they run one right after another, one match, one game, one event. You know, it's track and field. Okay, it's track and field. So what? Well, you know, it's up the floor and out the door. And it makes it difficult, I guess. 68 Olympics, I think, was the first one held in Mexico City. Or in the country of Mexico. In fact, one first one held south of the border anywhere. And I think the next one was Sao Paulo in 71 for the Pan Am Games. So I think, no, it was a... it was a defining moment, and it signified a huge amount of change in the way the Olympics are run. They've been run differently ever since. You know, Avery Brundage has been out. He was a polarizing figure. That was his last Olympics, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe he didn't get out till 72. Hell, I can't remember. Anyway.
I can't remember either. I want to say those were his last, but I'm not sure either.
Right.
So if you were going to give advice to someone today, to a young athlete today who was interested in pursuing an Olympic dream, what advice would you give?
Go for it. Spend the time. Do it. Don't hold back. You know, pursue your dreams. You know, even though, you know, the odds are against you, they, what, 1% make it or something like that, if you follow me, you know, and people are saying, I mean, I've heard many people say, well, why do you want to do that, only 1% make it or something like that, but it's the idea of you know, making the effort. making the attempt, and all the things that you learn doing that serve you well the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like sage advice.
Well, when you get to be my age, dear, you've got a lot of advice.
Well, do you have any other advice for us or anything else you'd like to tell us?
No, I don't know exactly what it is you're doing, but I certainly like to see the results of it someday, whenever you put it all together. I'm not quite sure what it is you're doing.
Okay, I'd be happy to explain that. But before I turn off the recorder, did you have any other parting words or anything for the recorder?
No, and except that what a wonderful opportunity it was, and how much I remember that. I remember the 68 Olympics a lot more than I do the 72.
Fascinating. That's good. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and stop the recorder, and then I will explain a little bit more to you about the project and what is going to come from it.
Okay, sure, go ahead.